and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and we're going to be talking to Dr. Elliot Dasher tonight about his new book and accompanying CD, Aware, Awake, and Alive, about many topics, about how consciousness, how to be in the moment, addiction, peace of mind, depression, PTSD. So how are you, Elliot? Thanks for being with me tonight. It's a great, fabulous book.
Thank you, and I'm fine. Delighted to be here with you and your listeners.
So before we get started, if you would tell us a little bit about yourself and where people can find you.
Well, I'm a physician by training, and I practiced full-time internal medicine for 20-some years in Washington, D.C. area before I took a long journey back and forth to Indonesia to study the inner aspects of healing, consciousness, and the philosophies and the meditative practices, and then began to teach here. And this book is really an outcome of that. I think more details on my background can be found on my website, Elliot, ELLIOTTDACHER.org, ElliotDasher.org.
And you said here, where is here?
You mean where is here is my home? Oh, where have I been teaching? Well, when I came back, I live on Martha's Vineyard on the East Coast off of Cape Cod, and when I returned from one of my trips, because it's been a continuous process of an education for me, I decided I really wanted to work with people in my own local community where I could be with people over days, over weeks, over years, and have a kind of one-to-one continuity of teaching and follow-up, because I found that relationship was so important for me when I went to learn in the East. So I began teaching at a local hospital about 6 years ago, a 10-session course, which was a course that focused on the experiential process of teaching people meditation and meditative techniques, and also gave them significant content so they could begin to understand the process intellectually. And so I have maintained that practice here and now other places as well. And it was the course manual from that program, which has now been done probably 20 times with several hundred people, that really became the basis for the book.
It's a great book, Elliot. I think I told you earlier, I thought that we were going to be spending an hour. You know, most people when they talk about consciousness and meditation, they talk about being in the moment and listening, being still and listening. So it's so hard to talk about being still and listening in an hour, but this book has so much more information and so much more language that helps people understand what you're trying to help them do. So it's a great job. Thank you.
Thank you.
So the first thing I want to ask you about that you start off in your, well, you don't even, is the first question is, you talk about consciousness. What is that to you?
Well, consciousness for me is simply awareness. I think that would be an interchangeable a word. Of course, there are different forms of consciousness. We have an eye consciousness, in a sense, and an ear consciousness, and a taste consciousness, and we have a consciousness that's reflected in thoughts, feelings, and images. So all these are aspects of consciousness. But the basic foundation of consciousness is an awareness, which can experience itself in any of those other ways. But basically, it's an awareness, an open, settled, quiet awareness of things, how they are, whether it's sensory, whether it's mental.
Okay. The first thing you start off in Chapter 2, that's where I'm kind of starting, is free will. Could you tell us why it's important to understand free will, and what is it, and what are the limitations?
Well, I think most of us would say that we have free will, but one would really, like most things, if we analyze that issue rather than just take our immediate opinion of it, we would realize that even that statement that I have free will is already conditioned by our past history and the things we've learned about independence, about freedom, and so on and so forth. But the reality is that most of our thoughts, feelings, and actions, be they of speech or be they physical actions, are really conditioned by previous experience. There's very, very little that we do that does not have as its origins some previous experience, whether that's an interpretation or whether that's an action. So there's not really a lot of free will until we are able to access those places in our awareness and our consciousness that, in fact, are not conditioned or do not have those kinds of mental habits and patterns and ways of reactivity, until we can really come to the source that is below all that conditioned behavior, we really don't find any free will. And since we don't spend time learning how to sit in a place of just pure non-conceptual awareness, we don't really experience anything that isn't related to our past history. So free will will come from a freedom that is a freedom from the known. One has to be free of everything that's known within oneself and therefore has an influence over the present moment to be able to really have what I would call freedom.
That's a very good description. The next question is human flourishing. How did you learn to directly observe the joy, and how did you observe joy or peace or serenity or flourishing, whatever you want to call it?
I think what happened for me is I ended up in India by some serendipitous set of circumstances and ended up then in Dharamsala, where the Tibetan people are, and got to really experience the Dalai Lama and other Tibetan teachers firsthand, and I simply saw on their face a peace and a gentleness and a joy and a love that was something I had never seen in my life before, and I basically just said, okay, tell me what to do, because I can see you have it. That's really where I saw it, I think, in its most developed form.
I guess you didn't have a lot of outside stimulation, so you were able to follow them and be still. Huh?
Well, it was just a question of I didn't really know what path I'd go down, and although human flourishing is deep in the Western tradition as well as it is in the Oriental and in the Judeo-Christian tradition and as well as it is in the Buddhist tradition and the Hindu tradition, it's not new. It has different names in all those traditions. But, you know, I never really had seen individuals that had that kind of consistent joy and delight and peace and ease about themselves. It's not that we can't see that here, maybe next door or down the street in certain people, but I never saw it with that kind of consistency and authenticity and development. And it just clarified to me that what Aristotle had wrote about, what he called eudaimonia, what the Buddhists had talked about, wisdom and compassion in the Christian tradition, the longing for the divine and the return with an agape, caring for all people. The Hindu tradition calls it satchitananda, awareness, existence, bliss. In the Oriental tradition, they call it the Tao. So all of these traditions, across time, across cultures, have told us there is a way of being, a way of living, a set of potentials and possibilities that we can each reach as individuals, which is rather extraordinary and far from what we consider to be ordinary. But I don't think I ever saw it as clearly as I saw it at that time. And it was quite inspiring personally to me, and of course it indicated to me that there was a lot more to healing that I had to learn about than I already knew.
So how did they teach you? One of the things that you talk about in your book is clearing mind. How do you do that? How do you stop and get rid of everything that's flowing through what I call little mind and you know, everyday thoughts, I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to stop doing this, I need to go here, I need to go there, or this is wrong or that is wrong. How do you do that?
Well, there's several ways. Just to introduce that.
And what do you mean by that? Sorry, also, what do you mean
by
that?
Yes, that's a fair question. Just to introduce that very briefly, the issue of suffering in all its forms, distress, stress, mental afflictions, more intense suffering, is in the mind. and human flourishing, the qualities of human flourishing, enduring happiness, penetrating wisdom and authentic compassion, a content and delight, a peace that surpasses understanding of the Bible. So all these things are in the mind. They're all part of our experience. And to work with the mind is the only way we can eliminate the sources of suffering and distress and open up these natural qualities of human flourishing that reside within us. But to work with the mind, we have to first be able to quiet it down, because the overactive and noisy mind, there's nothing we can do with that. It's just follow the noise wherever it takes us, to this set of words, to this action, to this daily activity. So unless we can quiet the mind, we really can't begin to work with it or examine it or deal with the issue of alleviating the causes of distress and suffering and bring forth these qualities of human flourishing. So traditionally there have been any number of ways to quiet the mind, and it's really a progressive process. Whereas in the beginning, we really learned in a way to suppress it by using the breath and focusing on the breath, maintaining our intention until the mind quiets down and not following any thoughts, feelings, or images into the past and elaborating them with stories or ruminating in the present or projecting them out to the future. So we learn how to do that in the beginning. Of course, it's a very basic form of quieting, and we can quiet with mantras, with yoga, and other kinds of activities. But eventually, you begin to understand the nature of the noise in the mind or the moving mind or the thoughts, feelings, and images much better. And one begins to understand their nature, one understands that they, in fact, are very brief. They last for less than 200 of a millisecond. They arise and then they fall. So we begin to understand the nature of why we turn what are very brief neuroelectrical blips into long conversations that run our life is really the next set of stages in this process. So the suppression of the mind through diverting our attention is really very beginning, just to get us started, to clear a little bit out there. But eventually we learn how the mind works, the moving mind, the still mind, and it's that understanding that returns us to the natural state of the mind, which there are thoughts to go through and feelings to go through, but we don't get pulled by them. We remain in our settledness, the same as an ocean remains an ocean even though there are waves, or space remains space even though there may be birds flying through. So we learn that the problem is not the mental movements, but the fact that we grasp onto them and lose our basic home of awareness. We grab onto them, we make them larger, we elaborate them. That's the problem. So there are these different phases going from coarse, which is suppressing the mind, to very subtle understanding the nature of the mind that eventually frees us quite naturally from this problem.
So one of the things you talk about to do that is your mindful breathing. And what I actually did that. You know, I live up in the mountains today, so I drug my meditation chair out in my woods and on a big rock and did what you said. It's a little bit different than most people say. You say breathe in 5 times and breathe out, and then you talk about stopping at your peak. I found that very interesting. So could you talk about that for a few minutes, how people do that?
Well, we start usually a meditation with, and it can actually, this part can go on for a good part of the meditation, depends upon the person. We're taking a deep breath in, holding at the peak of inspiration, the breath, and then we can let the breath out, and then we can hold again at the bottom of expiration. The hold is a very interesting place. We're holding our breath, something physiologically takes place that's always been known about the relationship of breath to consciousness, and that's the mind stops on its own. There's a gap that's created when we hold our breath, and that gap is really what allows us to see our naturally settled mind, because there's very little mental activity when we're holding our breath. It's just really a gap. The fact is, it's like the sun and the clouds are parted, and we're seeing what's already there, which is this place of non-distraction and of peace and of calm. And when you begin to hold the breath, the first thing that comes is really a kind of a sense of voidness or emptiness, a quietness. There's just nothing there. And then there develops an awareness that comes into it. And then we suggest that people try to carry that through the next expiration, then refresh that in the holding again, come through the inspiration, refresh it in the inspiration. So we're doing two things with that. We're bringing our mind down to a quieter place, quieting down the coarse noise before we begin the actual meditation process. And at the same time, we're getting familiar with this gap, which is the gap between two thoughts, essentially. It's where we can actually discover who and what we are in our natural state. So it has those two purposes. And sometimes people do it for a short period. They go into the meditation process. Other times they may do it for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, if it's continued, it's going to quiet the mind down.
So my next question is discerning wisdom. My question is it's knowing what and what not to discern. What do you mean by discerning, and then how do you know what and what not to discern?
Well, that's in the chapter on cultivating and abandoning, and there's two kinds of discerning wisdom. There's the one discerning wisdom that comes over time with meditation and accessing the deeper levels of our mind, and that discerning wisdom is the wisdom that knows the nature of self, of reality, and of phenomena. That's not what I'm talking about in that chapter. In that chapter, we're talking about the discerning wisdom that can know the difference between those things which will assist our process of growing to a larger health and growing a healthier mind, and those things that get in the way of growing our health and growing a clearer and more healthy mind. So it's actually quite a wisdom, and we can go through each day, as I suggest in the book, and look, does this thing help me grow my life? Now, this thing could be, the issue could be as simple as a conversation that's rather meaningless and trivial. Does that really help me quiet my mind? Does that help me live my life in a healthier way? Or it may be what my needs are, what my wants are. It may be my belief system that health is purely a biological affair, which is one that's prevalent in our culture. Does that help my overall health, or does it not? So, and there are a number of things I mentioned in that chapter, but what I really want people to do is to really look at everything we do in the daytime and say, is that going to help us create a happier, healthier life, or is it not? And if it is, cultivate it. And if it isn't, abandon it. Because if you throw a seed on a rock, that is, if you take this kind of training, this kind of effort to develop a larger life by developing what's inner life, and you throw it on a place that can't grow, then it's going to die. So we have to not only develop the mental practices, the daily practices, the formal sitting practices, the understandings that are related to this work through study, reflection, and practice. We also have to begin to set up our lives so that it supports what we do. And that's a wisdom in itself.
Yeah, I agree. It's such an important thing.
And it can be quite subtle, you know. It really can.
Yeah. The next question I have is about suppressing overactive mind. That's a big one. That's a hard one. Can you tell us how we can better do that?
Well, you know, it takes time. And strangely enough, as we begin to explore our mind, it's not as difficult as we might think. But it's not only a question of suppressing our mind. It's also a question of growing our life, as we just talked about, in ways that support a quieter mind. So there are two sets of practices, basically, we use. One is this formal sitting practice, which utilizes the breath as the focal point until the mind quiets down, and then we sit in that quietness and learn about it. But the second that we emphasize, because we're not living in monasteries or seminaries, we don't have 12, 13 hours a day to do practice, so we have to turn everything that we can during the day into daily practices. So we teach a series of them, and two of them, for instance, would be becoming more mindful during the day. That is, every time we're doing a particular activity, we may choose one a day, like eating or another activity. We take our attention, we bring it onto that activity, the same as we would into our breath and when we're doing meditation, and we focus right on that activity. And if our mind starts wandering or analyzing too much, or we go right back to the activity. whether it's eating, whether it's walking. And when we do, we begin to find ourselves more vividly involved with nowness. And when we're in nowness, in the moment, in the actual experience that's happening, the mind actually quiets. The other practice we use is very powerful is mindful listening. Certainly we're listening all day long, but do we really listen? So we learn to listen as a meditation. The focal point is not the breath, or it's not walking in nature, it's the other person's speech. And most people are never heard in their life, but we are rarely ever heard really completely and fully. So we learn when we're listening with somebody, we do the same thing we do when we're meditating. If our mind begins to interpret, to judge, to compare, to I like, I don't like, to formulating responses, any time mental activity comes up that takes it back to ourself and to our mental experience, we let go of it and go back again to the listening. Let go back to the listening. Let go back to the listening. So this is really a meditation. At the end of listening, you're both connected to the other person, you have a much deeper sense of who and what they are, and you and them should both be in a quieter place. So we use all of these practices during the day and in formal practice to be able to cultivate the process by which progressively our mind slows down.
Next question is affliction and disturbing emotions. In your book, you talk about avoidance, distancing, and antidotes. Could you give us a little bit about what you mean by those?
Well, there's seven ways in the book to approach afflictive emotions, those being anger, jealousy, excessive pride, attachment, the whole host of it, stress, anxiety. And we begin with the coarsest ones, and avoidance would be the coarsest. That means there are certain situations we're not yet able to be in without, in fact, reacting intensely to them. And in those situations, we simply, if we can, we just avoid them. We can't always. But, you know, we don't want to go into a burning house and expect not to get burned unless we have fire-retardant gear on, and the fire-retardant gear, in terms of the mind, is a more stable and still mind than a more understanding mind. So until we can develop a mind, there are situations we really just need to stay away from. A little bit less coarse, but still coarse, is this issue of distancing, trying to label, for instance, an emotion when it comes up, a thought, feeling, or image. If we're not already into it like a fire and deeply stuck, we may have the space to label something. We may have the space to say, do I want this? Is this helping me? Is it not, this emotion? We may be able to do one or two techniques that I described there in the book to create some spaciousness before we really get deeply in it. And it goes more subtle than that, and the issue of antidotes would be the next one. We know that the mind can't hold two feelings or thoughts at the same time. It may seem like that, but it can't. So if we cultivate mental attitudes that are opposite some of the more common afflictive emotions, we're not going to see those afflictive emotions arise. So, for instance, the attitude of loving kindness is the opposite of anger. You can't hold both of those at the same time. So, of course, in the moment, it's very difficult to cultivate loving kindness when you're angry. But if we begin to cultivate that as an attitude inside and with actions outside, simple actions, patience, tolerance, understanding, if we begin to cultivate that, we have the antidote that's sitting there, which is going to diminish our the ability for us to get hooked into something like anger. So the antidote to miserliness would be generosity, arrogance, humbleness, and so forth. So there are mental qualities that we do develop in this work that help us counteract on a long term the tendency of our mind to be taken over by these afflictive emotions. And these are just still the coarse approaches, and then there are more subtle approaches that have to do with understanding the nature of the afflictive emotions themselves and the nature of how the mind works. And as we do that, we really cut the root of afflictive emotions and it can bring them to an end. They definitely can be brought to an end.
How do you advise or teach people to deal with people that they to have interactions with people that they don't like or that they have animosity going on with?
Well, there are a number of different approaches, but let me just take the issue of not liking somebody because of their behavior. Somebody is angry, somebody is difficult, somebody is very negative. If we begin to understand, and this gets now to the more subtle levels, if we begin to understand that when people are negative or reactive or angry, that they basically are doing that involuntarily. Every one of us wants happiness, and every one of us wants to be free of suffering. Nobody would argue with that. So if somebody is acting in a way that's going to bring on anger or suffering to themselves and to others, they obviously aren't thinking very much, because that isn't the normal natural instinct that we have. And so to begin to see that people, when they're reactive, when they're angry, when they're negative, when they're hostile, are really out of control. They're automatically following some pattern of reactivity within them that's really quite automatic. There's no actual thought involved, and all the conditions and circumstances come together to be negative or difficult. Boom, it happens without any, I think I'll be difficult. So as we begin to understand the helplessness and the painfulness and the suffering that somebody who is like that goes through continuously in their life with many other people, and that what they're doing isn't really aimed at us specifically, it's just their conditioned negativity that's causing them so much suffering and pain, we begin to see people from a place of compassion and not from one of anger, not from one of reacting to them, because we see the truth of how their mind works, the truth of what's happening, and their powerlessness over all of this. Doesn't mean we don't set up boundaries. It doesn't mean we don't choose effective ways to deal with people. But it means that our heart is in the right place. Our heart feels okay. Our heart is open. It's not affected. And we can be much more effective in handling that person from that perspective. So some of it is simply understanding. Some of it is developing a loving kindness attitude towards everyone, irrespective of their behavior. Again, it doesn't mean that we have to be friends with everybody or even hang around. So we're working on our own inner attitude, our own inner response, and this is the thing that we can control. And if we understand really the truth of what makes difficult people difficult, there's no way but to just to feel compassion and open-heartedness towards those people.
You talk about something else in your book that I think is important, and that's how to know the difference. Well, knowing the difference between love and relationship. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the definition that we use for love in this work, and I think it's actually a fairly traditional one, is that love is wanting other people to be happy. That's pretty simple. That has nothing to do with emotion. And that has nothing to do with the character and of the kind of relationship we have with that person. Everybody wants to be happy. We want to be happy. Why wouldn't we want other people to have the same thing that we want for ourselves? And also, why wouldn't we want people to be free of suffering? We also want to be free of suffering ourselves. So this attitude of wanting somebody to be happy and to be free of any distress in your life is what would be called love in this particular vision of it. It's got nothing to do with how I interact with that person. It has nothing to do with my emotions and my feelings. And when you think about that, Eva, it's a really simple thing I found in my own life. It's a lot easier because, you know, you ask yourself the question, is this behavior that I'm doing, is this loving? Is it supporting this person's happiness? Or is it about my needs? And if it's about my needs, it's about taking care of myself. It's not about loving another. So it's that definition that really shifts things around and focuses the effort on really a concern for others rather than a concern fulfilling my own needs.
Let's talk next about adversity. How do you face it? And is it possible for it to be a catalyst to something else? And if so, what is that something else?
Well, sometimes it's helpful. Yes, it does. And sometimes it's helpful to look at situations which are remarkable. Not that we're all capable of it, but they indicate to us what is possible for the human condition. So if we look, for instance, at a Nelson Mandela who spent 25 years in a prison, probably a good amount of that in solitary confinement, here's a man who had one of the worst circumstances or worst situations or great adversity, as we would define it, and yet he comes out mentally healthier than when he went in. The Dalai Lama always talks about a monk, who an old monk who came over the mountains, who was in Chinese prison for 20 years and humiliated and starved and many of the things that happened in that kind of a setting. And he asked him, what was your most difficult moment? And his answer was, when I thought I'd lose compassion for my captors. So here, and there are many other stories like this, and common people as well as those that we know. So what we know is that adversity does not necessarily have to lead to despair. It can lead even to a more mental, healthier life. That is, it can be an opportunity to grow and to develop and to mature. And so adversity, which is something we don't like, can really be turned into an opportunity. We don't go around looking for it, but it can be turned into a teaching opportunity, something that can break open our life, show us new directions, give us new insights into what is really important and valuable. And so all adversity, small, large, can be used as a teaching moment by each of us, or we can collapse into despair, either are possible. But to know that it is possible for people to go through the most difficult moments in life and come out healthier is something that should inspire all of us to see the little adversities that we look at in life each day as opportunities and challenges to go further and to grow a larger health in life.
I don't want to get off on this for a long time, but I want to say this about this. One of the things in the book that I'm writing on consciousness, when I was interviewing these luminaries, for lack of a better word, one of the things I asked them was, before you had your spiritual shift, because most of the people that I interviewed had had a big bang experience, you know, like a big spontaneous spiritual epiphany thing that rattled their lives. Every one of them, every single one of them said within the last 2 years that they had had some kind of significant dark night of the soul. And they believed, including myself, that adversities had been put in front of their faces for years, that they approached them like a salmon swimming upstream rather than relaxing into them. They would fight them. And finally, it got to the point where the adversity got to be so bad that it put their nose on the pavement, where there was not any more. It couldn't get any worse. The adversity couldn't get any worse. It was terrible. And at that moment, something wonderful happened, and the light popped on. When they rounded the corner, so I think that everybody would agree that without those adversities, none of us would have been where we were to wake up and have peace, or at least a better perspective and peace in our lives to deal with the have peace even in the middle of adversity. If that makes any sense.
Well, it sure does, and thank you for offering that. And beyond that, we have to ask, why do we wait for these major upheavals in our life? Because, you know, feeling alone and loneliness, or feeling doubt or confusion or meaningless, or this nagging feeling that there's more to life, or having relationships which are dull, all of these are suffering. All of these are adversity. We just don't see them that way. We've gotten so accommodated to the big ones. And so it's important for us to see suffering in its more subtle forms, so that we don't have to wait until it reaches an epiphany for us to really open up into something new. And that may be what happens for many of us, but we have to see that from the perspective of somebody who's living a larger life in health, the way most of us live every day, our ordinary lives, our automated robot-like lives, our lives that are rather dull, that don't have deep meaning in them, that have confusion and doubt and not deep satisfaction or deep happiness, that these are lives of suffering.
Okay, I have several more, but I'm going to get this one since we only have 20 minutes left. like for you to talk about the health aspect, about addiction, heart disease, depression, ADHD, and post-traumatic stress syndrome. I'd like for you to talk about those because so many of us have those.
Well, these are, of course, epidemics of our time, and it would be, I think, fair to say that each of them is multidimensional and has multiple causes, and it would be unfair to say just the mind or just the body or just the environment or just the family is the cause of any of these things. They're complex diseases, but within that complexity, perhaps one of the most unexplored components or contributing factors is really the state of the mind, and that state of the mind can be a much stronger factor, or it can be more minor to biology. But when we look at addictive disorders and we look at stress and post-traumatic stress, which are a continuum, or we look at heart disease, which we know is related very much to our lifestyle and our mind style, we look at mood disorders, attention deficit disorder, it would be very difficult to say that the mind does not play a role and a significant role in each of these disorders. And that's not to say it's the only factor, but certainly it is one that we can work on and have not. And so if we can accept that, which I think is easy to do, and then we could accept that there are methods and practices and paths by which we can explore the mind, come to expand our understandings, come to places of great peace inside and wisdom inside and heartfeltness, then those qualities are qualities that are going to have some impact on each of those disorders. Now, if we take addictive disorders to begin with, addictive disorders have been really quite well described historically in the literature. And in fact, if we take the AA movement and their own history, we know from letters between Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, and Carl Jung, the great psychologist, that the actual origins of AA really started in many ways in Dr. Jung's office with the patient who was an alcoholic, who Jung told his case was helpless because he was trying to use spirits in terms of alcohol in lieu of a spiritual development, and sent him to but he then went on to a process of spiritual development at a group at Oxford, and AA came out of that. So here we see that alcohol was an addiction that was seeking a form of relief from suffering or some kind of pleasant moment experience, which of course is only temporary and creates more addiction, because inside there wasn't accessible and available authentic spirit with its happiness, with its wholeness, with its peace, with its inner satisfaction. And so here we can apply this to almost all addictive disorders, that the mind has this role in it, that once it finds this place inside of stillness and peace and happiness, it really, really undercuts a lot of the process of looking outside, whether it's alcohol, relationships, experiences, material things, for satisfaction, because it's already inside. So this is the role that spiritual development or inner development really has in these disorders, and in post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a more intense process than stress, but it is related. Of course, this takes place in the mind as well. So if we can work with the mind, develop it, understand it better, develop practices and methods that can calm it, that can see more clearly, they certainly will have some effect upon that disease. And the same thing, obviously, with attention deficit disorder, because attention is a mental factor that can be cultivated through work on the mind. And heart disease, we know, is related to stress in many ways. So all of these disorders can benefit from the development of the mind. And the question is, that being so obvious and apparent, why is it that we don't do that in this culture?
So why do you think, Why did you pick just these four or five? Is it, why didn't you include like a gallbladder or a liver? Is there something that stands out about these particular diseases that's significant with meditation or being in the moment? I'm trying, because I mean, I have people in my life that have every single one of these things. Like my family, one has addiction, one has heart disease, one's had depression, one's had ADHD, and somebody has PTSD. I mean, so it's interesting to me to understand this better.
Well, I would think that because the reason is because these conditions likely have a more dominant aspect of the mind in terms of their in terms of it being a contributing factor, than it may be in gallbladder disease, which doesn't mean that our mental attitude in some way doesn't relate to that, but it's probably less of importance than it is in issues like post-traumatic stress, heart disease, addictive disorders, and so on. So I pick those merely as examples in the book of illnesses that and disorders that we know have a predominant mental component to them. I mean, it's obvious. And so these are the ones I've picked. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have some role in other illnesses at all, other than that. But, you know, if we take things like pneumonia or gallbladder disease or infectious disease or surgical diseases, there will be less of a role, which doesn't mean it doesn't play a role in both contributing to the disorder and the healing of the disorder, but it isn't as dominant.
Okay. Depression, you talk about an exit strategy. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think that in a traditional Eastern family, for instance, a child grows up with, you know, 10 or 20 or more relatives, always somebody to cuddle, always somebody to hug, always somebody to be present, give wise advice, listen. And at the same time in those families, they learn a philosophy of open-heartedness, of otherness. They learn how to work with the mind from early on. Children can watch their parents sitting quietly, studying, doing meditation. They learn these same techniques from the very beginning. So they know about suffering and they know about distress. It's part of their philosophical kind of training, even as children. And they know that there's places to go inside to begin to work with it. In the West, we don't know that. The only place we learn to go when we're not feeling good is outside. We learn to go to relationships, to things, to people, to drugs, something outside to make us feel better. But what happens when all those things don't work anymore? Because they're all temporary to begin with. And where do we go? We simply get more and more depressed because we really have no way out if all these external things no longer work, and they don't. And we don't have any way out. We don't know how to work with the mind. We don't know how to work with the heart. We don't know even that there's a place within inside all of us that is immune to all outside adversity, that is immune to mood disorders, that is immune to stress, that is immune to distress. At least we haven't developed this natural home of ours. So as we have no exit from adversity and the depression around it, except to go into despair. But in fact, there is an exit, and that exit is develop our inner life where those things aren't even present. We have a refuge. We have a place we can go in capacities and skills and knowings that give us a life that's quite rich and full as an alternative. So we have a place to go. People who learn that early in life. But in the West, we don't learn that. So where do we go? We go to despair or depression when things get very, very bad because there is no way out. There is no way out. There are antidepressants, if they work perhaps for a while. There are drugs of other sorts, illegal. Maybe they'll help for a little bit. But there's no real way out. The only way out is in, and we don't know how to go in the West. And so we have no exit.
That is great language to describe what you mean, Elliot. Thanks for coming up with that. Thanks for listening to figure that out. I want you to talk about the four treatment goals for PTSD, but we've got about 8 minutes. So know that you can also cover anything else that you want to talk about in those few minutes before we have to wind up. So make it as brief or as elaborate as you want, and then take the rest of the time to talk about what you want to talk about.
Yeah. Well, if I could, I'd like to speak more generally, and then rather than specifically about post-traumatic stress, because what I want to say is we have these precious time, and it really applies to these disorders, plus all the other kinds of disorders we have that disturb us on a day-to-day level. And the one thing I want to say first is that there is that all suffering, distress, and stress, all of it can be overcome. All of it can be eliminated. I'm not saying that tomorrow we turn around and it's gone. I'm simply saying that we know that disorders of stress, distress, and the general kind of suffering that we have with the adversities of life are not built into our psychological genes. They are add-ons and superimpositions. We see people who go through great adversity and don't suffer, as I mentioned before. And the qualities of a richer life, of an enduring happiness, a deep peace, a real wisdom, an authentic compassion and love, these are innate to our life. And so my encouragement is for everyone to realize that if we wish to deal with things of the mind, we have to come to develop and understand our mind. We have to work with it, and there are many, many methods. There are many practices. We certainly want to get helpers that know what they're doing. We have to be very careful about that in this culture. But if we get good guides, we are committed and motivated and begin when we're healthy rather than when we're ill, then we create over the time, we create a stable foundation both of an innerness and of a peacefulness that can remain quiet and stable even in the face of very difficult adversity. And I would encourage everybody to know the truth of that. And I think this book kind of gives a very good introduction. It's a practice book, so it actually gives a whole path. But there are many other resources available that can help teach that. But people have to be very careful because this is a very precious process, and you really need to find the right people. And in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder, we know that of the number of people that go into very, very adverse circumstances, such as war or abuse, that a very small percentage, maybe 10% or less, actually have these post-traumatic stress disorders. So we have to ask why 80, 90% not. And there are probably many reasons, but we certainly can prepare people in life in general to be more resilient and more hardy in the face of adversity by developing...
I have a question. 20% don't have it before they come in or after they come out?
We know that of the number of people that go through major adversity, there are a very small percentage that end up with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Really?
So you have to ask, why not the rest of them? Why not the rest?
It would have been more than that. That's interesting.
It's a small percentage. And so... you know, why not? There are many reasons, but what we can do is prepare people. We can, if we prepare an inner life, a healthier life, we become more hardy and resilient to all kinds of adversity. So preparation, working with the mind when people do suffer from that, is another way of working on it. So there are many, many different approaches, but the basic thing is that we need to prepare our mind to really be able to be in life through good things, good times, and bad times with the stability like the deep ocean that doesn't get disturbed by the waves on its surface. And we can do that. And if we can do that, we're going to avoid the chaos of much of adversity.
So what else? You've got about 6 minutes, 5 or 6, 7 minutes, something like that. Anything else you want to talk about that we have not talked about? Or even if we have?
Well, you know, the astonishing thing to me, as I've been teaching this stuff over the last number of years, and, you know, everything I teach is really something I've learned from somebody else, nothing, it's my own creation. It's material that's been transmitted for generations, is how easy it is for people when they have skillful teaching tailored to their own personality to begin to practice meditation formally once a day and in their daily activities and within weeks, literally within weeks. I have four classes now that are in their third week, and it's astonishing to go around the room and see the people less reactive, quieter, calmer. There's some still struggling a little bit more with the meditation. But in general, you'll begin to see within a short period of time changes in life. It's rather astonishing. And anybody can meditate. You can't do it with a formula. It's got to be tailored and worked through on a one-to-one or a small group basis. But anyone can do this work. If people do it, they will have the same result that everybody else that's done it for thousands of years has in both the Western and Eastern traditions. And so we take a lot of time preparing our body and protecting our body because we've learned to do that. But we spend very little time preparing or protecting our mind, and that's the work that we need to do at this time in our culture in order to gain larger and healthier lives.
One thing I wanted to ask you is, once someone learns how to be still or be in the moment, however you want to phrase it, does it stay there? You do it one time and get it. You know, there it is. I feel it. I feel what it feels like. Does it just stay there for the rest of your life, or do you have to keep doing it, practicing?
Well, it's a progressive process of study, reflection, and practice. So it's not something that is going to happen to us and all of a sudden it remains there. There's both an immediate effect of when you're doing practices in that particular day, both in daily life and in formal practice, and then there's a cumulative effect over time. But, you know, any time any of us can walk into a situation which is more than we can handle, and we just kind of get reactive. But if we look at the progress over 6 months or a year or 3 months or 2 years, we see that our life has changed, that we are a little bit less reactive, happier, more peaceful. So it's a progressive process. It's like any education. It's an ongoing, continuous education, and it becomes our life. It's how we live. We listen to people. We're mindful. We're in the present moment. Same way as we brush our teeth in the morning, we learn to get up and clean our mind in the morning. So we develop these habits, and they provide both immediate, short-term, as well as long-term benefits.
I think it's important for people to understand, because many people give up. They feel it that first time for a minute, and they think that it's going to stay there forever. They don't realize that they have to keep putting some vested interest there. That it, you know, anything you don't practice doesn't stay.
That's right. I mean, but over time, it's not just practicing. By studying and understanding the sources of affliction and the place that we find inside that has these more stable qualities, that also has a long-term impact. So we begin to build on it. But yet it takes time for people to get situated in practice, some very quickly, they're there and they continue going. Others go back and forth over a couple of years. So I would say, in general, to create a habit like brushing the teeth and get the results out of it is probably 6 months, 1 year, 2 years until that habit is really set in place. It's like a workout, you know. You get used to it after a while, and then it becomes regular. The difference is, workout, you drop off, and it completely drops off. But if you do the right work with study, reflection, and practice, and have very good teaching, then it doesn't really drop right off. It may diminish, it may go down, but once you do it, it becomes part of your life because you see the richness that it adds to life.
It's a wonderful thing. So tell us one more time where we can find you, Elliot.
My website is www.myname.org. And the books can be found under the same name on any of the online sellers.
Thank you so much, Elliot. It's been such a pleasure to have you, and it's a fabulous book. I love it. It's a great book. Thank you.
Great. It's
and I hope you'll come back.
Be.
And I hope you will come to the Alliance for Addiction Solutions and give us a presentation there, too, in a couple of months.
I would be delighted. Thank you, and good night to your listeners.
Thank you. Good night,
Bye-bye.
Elliot.
Bye-bye.